Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 96 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and a general dermatologist with the University of Utah. Currently feeling a little under the weather. My voice might sound a little funny. It is COVID, I'm afraid. But by the time you guys are listening to this, I'll be well over it. I mean, God willing, it's going to be 3 or 4 weeks from now. So appreciate the sympathies in advance, and I'm feeling great by the time you listen to this. And of course, joining me is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas. I have said that so many times, and I was like thinking about something, and my brain just like went left out the window. But so... Beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas, yes. And we have a guest.
I was going to ask, were you thinking about the pimping bell? Because we'd normally introduce the pimping bell here, too.
I was getting very excited about our guest, but we can introduce the pimping bell first. Hello, pimping bell.
The pimping bell rings to highlight especially question-worthy or testable content. And that's not the only guest, as you alluded to, Michelle. I will let you introduce our guest.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. We have as our guest today, the inestimable Steve Feldman. We're so excited to have him back. He's a favorite of the show, and we are going to talk about one of his favorite topics, behavioral economics.
Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Feldman. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Sure, I'm Steve. I'm a professor of dermatology at the Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
And you have joined us before, which was an excellent discussion back in episode 82. And at that point, we mostly talked about adherence because that is one of your primary research foci. And you also have an interest in behavioral economics, as do I. We have talked about it before in the podcast. You can find one discussion on it in episode 57. That article also won the Dermy Award. Well, it won the runner-up for coolest thing we learned back in 2021. Speaking of Dermy Awards, Dr. Feldman, at the end of every calendar year, we give out some awards, and I'm about to cause a rift in the space-time continuum because Michelle and I have recorded that episode. It hasn't aired yet, though, but I will say congratulations to you for winning the Best Overall Dermy Award in the year 2022 for the discussion that we had back in episode 82.
Oh my, Yay! That's like my second Dermy. This is great.
That's right. You also won for Stories is Greater Than Data the year prior. So you wrote this book that our listeners can't see because this is a podcast, but I'm holding it up right now. You sent it to me. Thank you. It's called Behavioral Economics for Healthcare Professionals. And I'm really interested in economics. I listen to all of the episodes of Freakonomics podcast, for example, and behavioral economics is a portion of that. And when you hear economics, you might, if you're not so super familiar with it, think that this has something to do with money. And it really doesn't. It's more about human behavior. So the term behavioral economics might be a little bit of a historical accident. It's more about psychology and human behavior. At least that's my take on it, Steve. You might have a different way of describing it.
Well, that's a good way to describe it. I'm basically a nerd. And I remember organic chemistry. It was great because all you needed to know is a few principles about what electrons are looking for. And you could describe all of everything in that massive organic chemistry textbook. And the college I went to, the University of Chicago, was known for giving people a broad curriculum, but I only wanted to study chemistry, physics, and math. That's really all I wanted to do. But they made me take, you know, something else. And so I took an economics course. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is like the physics of human behavior. You apply an incentive, which is like a force in physics, and people respond to it. And I think behavioral economics is an extension of our understanding. It's kind of like to normal economics, the way quantum physics is to classical physics. Mm-hmm. Things don't happen exactly the way you would have anticipated.
Mm-hmm. One of the central tenets of behavioral economics is that human beings are predictably irrational. So old school classic economics describes human behavior as rational. And then we discovered that we're not rational. We are quite the opposite in a lot of ways. But those ways are things that we can predict. So predictably irrational. And that's where behavioral economics comes in. And we as healthcare providers can use it to hopefully deliver better care to our patients. So obviously there's this book, Steve, but I would love to hear some of the most important things that you have taken out that you translate into your practice when you're taking care of patients.
Basically everything I do now, every moment of my visit with patients is designed to encourage them to use their medicines better. First, maybe the best example of behavioral economics in getting people to use medicine is what I use ubiquitously is the phenomenon of anchoring. If I tell mom, I need you to put this medicine on your child twice a day, she's probably thinking, oh my God, I got to chase that kid down twice a day. This is a nightmare. So instead, I like to start off by telling mom, I need you to do this. Need you to put this on your child four times a day. Do it before school. Have the school nurse do it at school. Do it after school, and then again at bedtime. And mom's thinking, I gotta get the school nurse to do this. Oh, I'm gonna have to schedule an appointment, miss work. I'm gonna have to fill out paperwork. I might have to get the paperwork notarized. I'm gonna need a second container of medicine. This is crazy. And then I go, no, like 2 seconds later, I say, no, wait, no. That's a lot. Let's just do it twice a day and maybe sometime in the morning and then once in the evening. She's like, oh, what a relief. I won't have to have the school nurse do it. So it's the same twice a day, but to the human brain, it's completely different. Mm-hmm.
I remember we had a conversation a little bit back in episode 82 with this stuff too. And I've been using one of the pearls that you brought in about medicines like dupilumab. So when I'm talking about that medicine, I'd say it's an injection, you know, like people with diabetes have to give themselves injections like four times a day. This is one injection every 2 weeks, which I think, you know, makes it sound a lot better than if you just led with it's a shot every 2 weeks.
One of the things I love about this area of work is that you can do fun little research studies that are fast. And so I sent my minions into the waiting room to find 100 psoriasis patients who'd never been on injection therapy. And we asked half of them, how willing would you be to take a shot once a month for your psoriasis? And their willingness was only 2 on a 1 to 10 scale. We asked the other 50, how willing would you be to take the shot once a day for your psoriasis? And then we asked them, how willing would you to be to take it once a month? Their willingness was 7 out of 10 willing. Oh, it's the same once a month question, but it went from basically no way to sure, why not? Mm-hmm. Just by anchoring people.
That's amazing.
I can't remember whether I've told you these stories before or not, but I was speaking at a dermatologist's office at lunch. And as I was walking in, I saw their sign that said Botox, $249. And I thought, well, they want to sell Botox, but that's a stupid sign. The sign should say Botox, $499. Mm-hmm. Cross that out and say $249 underneath. Mm-hmm. Special. Mm-hmm. I think that would be, people wouldn't be, they're, a computer wouldn't care. The computer would say it's $249. Mm-hmm. But a human faced with the first sign is going to say, I have to spend $249. Mm-hmm. And with the second sign, the human's going to say, I'm saving $250.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
Since we talked last, I've started to delve into this too, and it's fascinating. And if you pay attention, you can see how companies manipulate us all the time with this kind of stuff, like the time limited sale. An even better sign would be limited time only, $499 crossed out, $249, because people hate losing out on an opportunity, especially one that's special or rare, right? So it's kind of...
Yeah, it's so well said. You do know that they're manipulating. You can see it. And mm-hmm. the most fascinating thing of all is you can't stop it from manipulating. So even if you know they're manipulating you, you cannot control the effect that it has on you. I think a lot of it is like that, the blue vein on my wrist. You can know the blue color is an optical illusion because you know the blood is red. But if you look at your wrist, you're still going to see blue.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're a Vulcan, then you know the blood is truly blue.
I can see that COVID has not affected your nerdiness, Luke. I love that.
No, it's enhanced it, probably. just finished Discovery last night. So framing is another one that I use a fair amount in clinical practice. So this is sort of the 15% versus 85%. Which one do you tell the patients? So instead of saying, you know, there's a 2% risk of a side effect, I say there's a 98% chance you won't have any problems with this.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I had one patient who had horrible psoriasis and would not consider any biologic treatment because he thought they all caused liver disease.
Oh, gosh.
I think because he had them conflated with methotrexate.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell him there's zero risk of liver disease. So I said to the guy, they don't cause liver disease. What if there's only a 1 in 1,000 chance you'd get liver disease? He said, no, I wouldn't take the risk. I had a relative who died of cirrhosis. It was a slow, painful, lingering death. I would never take the chance. So I said to him, having read some behavioral economics books, I understand. Listen, what if I had another one where 99 out of 100 don't get cirrhosis? Would you take that? He was like, well, yeah, sure. Which is a tenfold higher risk.
Significantly.
But it just sounds so much better.
Yeah, sometimes the way we present data as scientists makes sense to our scientist brain, but we're not making a decision in the same place as the patient is because it's not affecting us personally. So that sort of animal behavior they talk about in behavioral economics doesn't get engaged. And it's interesting because you can see other people being manipulated, and sometimes you can even notice that you're being manipulated, but you're right, you can't stop it from working on you either. You're like, but it's such a good deal, you know?
Even classical economic theory can have implications in why patients wouldn't listen to us. If you model the choice of whether to use sunscreen or not economically to a doctor, a dermatologist, it makes perfect sense. You should use sunscreen. For one, we're already married. You know, whether we get a date this weekend doesn't matter to us or not. Having a tan doesn't help. And we invest in ourselves for years before we make any money, which means we have a very low discount rate. And so we don't discount the future very much. But our patients, to them, you know, having a tan might mean getting a date this weekend. And they might have a high discount rate such that the future is not as important to them as the present. And so the advice that we give people may not make logical sense to them.
Now, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Especially for long-term decision-making, like you know, whether putting on sunscreen that's going to affect whether you get a skin cancer 30 years from now.
I was in the advisor role for the Sun Protection Outreach Teaching by Students program, the SPOTS program at the St. Louis University campus, and they used behavioral economics to teach teenagers about taking care of their skin. And one of the ways they did that was they first enlisted medical students to go out and do it because the medical students were close enough to be peer, like felt like a superior peer to the high school students, as opposed to us graduated physicians going out there with our wisdom and our gray hairs, you know. And then we framed it around, you're going to age faster, your skin's going to break out more, you're going to look like more kind of rough on the edges and things like that. And we also talked about people their age that things had happened to, but it was coming from a closer peer. And it was so much more effective than the traditional messaging in the white coat with the, you know, dignification of, you know, board certification. And certainly all of those credentials are important, but when it comes to reaching people on the ground, you have to figure out how to speak to them and how they're going to hear the message. It was really interesting.
A few things in the book that resonated with me personally as well. A couple I wanted to mention was rosy retrospection. So human brains tend to think back on stuff we've done and cast it in a rosy light. And the reasons for that are perhaps somewhat complicated. So if I decide to go on a trip to the Oregon coast, for example, and I go on that trip and I come back, I might think of it as great because, well, perhaps it was great. Perhaps I want to not have thought that I made a dumb choice by going to the Oregon coasts, you know, so perhaps I am biased to think that it was great, even if it wasn't. And so that sort of made me feel like experiences were more valuable than perhaps I had thought before, because I can always look back on them and I have the benefit of human nature providing me with a rosy retrospection to do it. And then there's another chapter in the book about the hedonic treadmill, which is about stuff. So once we get stuff like a fancy new smartphone, for example, we kind of get used to it and it becomes the new normal. And then it doesn't give us as much joy as it had originally. And so that's in some ways the opposite of the rosy retrospection. So those two chapters together made me feel that, experiences perhaps more valuable than stuff, even though you might not think that because stuff you have forever and the experience you just had the one time, but you have the memory forever.
Yes, I think that our lives are so incredibly wonderful compared to the lives of cave people.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know that we're any happier. And I think we just settle in for whatever our norm is, whatever, and then we address things from there. I think it was really helpful that I started my career buying a relatively inexpensive house and a relatively inexpensive car, and slowly working up, because if you start off big, you got nowhere to go.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to quote you to yourself, Steve, in kind of the same vein. You've got the last chapter here, or last paragraph in the hedonic treadmill chapter. You say, I guess I don't know that this is actually you. You wrote this with some co-authors, but with our cars, airplanes, central heating and air conditioning, air and food quality, cell phones, iPods, access to information over the internet, and indoor plumbing, we live better than most of the kings and queens in human history. If we can keep in mind that our worst days are better than the best days of most of the people who have ever lived, perhaps we can force our conscious minds to see past the hedonic treadmill and find continuous joy in the lives we lead. That stuck with me.
Yeah, that sounds really good. That's good advice. I wonder if I wrote that. Wouldn't surprise me if my partner in crime, the co-author book, Scott Davis, wrote that. He was a jewel to work with.
Well, this book sort of fired me up so much that I don't know that I want this discussion to be the end of it. I have this idea that maybe we can make this some kind of occasionally recurring miniseries where we can maybe hit each chapter, maybe bring in some of the authors of the book. You can come back sometimes if you want. What do you think, Steve? Does that sound cool?
Oh, my goodness. That sounds outstanding. Thank you.
We love having you on the show. You always have such brilliant insights, and the compassion and kindness that you show to your patients is something that I hope inspires the generation of dermatologists to come, because it's such a gift to understand how to help people.
And of course, we really appreciate you coming back, Steve. Any final words for our listeners, or any spots they can find you on social media or otherwise?
Surprisingly not. I don't have anything to add.
Perfect. All right. They can always search you up on PubMed and search for you on Dermasphere and Amazon, it sounds like. All right. We'll see you around, Steve. Stay All healthy, right. Everybody.
Yeah, you too. Thanks so much.
Steve Feldman has left the building, but that doesn't mean our discussions are over. Michelle, what should we talk about next?
Well, I don't know about you, but I like to start off the new year by learning about correlations between hormonal intrauterine devices and androgenic skin conditions, a retrospective cohort study. What do you think?
I do like that. I like it very much.
Awesome sauce. Well, we're going to review this article out of the JAD. The chief authors are Ananya Munjal and Jennifer Powers, and they are from the Department of Dermatology and Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Very exciting. So they wanted to look in this letter to the editor at long-acting contraceptives, which are used by 10.4% of American women aged 15 to 49 years old, often in the form of hormonal implanted intrauterine devices, or IUDs, which use levonorgestrel to prevent pregnancy. So levonorgestrel is one of several androgenic progesterones. And if you're like me, you know, these names kind of all run together and sound alike, and it can be a little hard to kind of organize them. So I tried to put together a little mnemonic to remember which progesterones are a little androgenic. So if you are a lady person or you frequent the late night shopping networks, you might have noticed that there is a hair removal device for use at home called the No-No, which is cute. And you kind of roll it over your skin. I don't know how well it works, but it works well for this mnemonic. So we'll use it. So the No-No hair removal device is a thing. And, you know, I like to think that if you have these androgenic progesterones on board, you might need a No-No hair removal device, or you might need some MD gel. So something that is, you know, medical grade gel potentially to just smooth back the hairs, I suppose. So the no-no is for norethindrone. So norethindrone is one of the androgenic progesterones. And then noralgestromin is another one. Noralgestromin is in the patch. Norethindrone is typically in OCPs and is in the mini pill. So that's the no-no part of that mnemonic. And you heard the pimping bell. Luke, do you want to explain the pimping bell briefly?
The pimping bell, as a reminder, hangs out to identify especially testable content. Pay attention when you hear the bell ring.
The MD part of this mnemonic is for medroxyprogesterone acetate and then desogestrel. So medroxyprogesterone acetate, of course, is Depo-Provera, which we all know causes androgenic side effects. Desogestrel is one of those that is used in OCPs. And then the gel part is gestidone, which is in OCPs, etanogestrel, which is in Nexplanon and the NuvaRing, and levonorgestrel, which is in the IUDs. So a lot of the non-pill forms of contraception do have these androgenic progesterones in them. So the NuvaRing, the Nexplanon, the Depo-Provera, and the levonorgestrel IUDs are all progesterones that are androgenic. And those are all kind of OCP alternatives. So that's potentially a way to help you remember and identify those ones. So no-no or MD gel to control your hirsutism from these androgenic progesterones. So pardon that light diversion. Now we'll go back into the meat of the article. So as we know, levonorgestrel is androgenic. It can play a role in disease and symptoms influenced by androgens. IUDs are associated with cases of new and worsening acne vulgaris, but no levonorgestrel specific risk of adverse dermatologic conditions had been established. So the authors attempted to do this to evaluate the association between hormonal IUDs and adverse dermatologic events. And they had a handy cohort of people to compare them to. Luke, can you imagine what they chose as their comparative cohort?
Perhaps people who had an IUD that was not hormonally active?
What a genius you are, Luke! That is exactly right! So, basically, they took records from the University of Iowa Hospital Clinics, and they used a database in the TRI-NX, which is a health research network, to allow them to do a retrospective cohort study using women with levonorgestrel IUDs. And then they looked at diagnoses including acne vulgaris, rosacea, androgenic alopecia, hirsutism, and looked at the development of those conditions within a year after implantation of the device between 2010 and 2020. That cohort was compared with women with the non-hormonal copper IUDs, in which these conditions developed within the same interval, and women with instances of the dermatologic conditions within 1 year prior to IUD insertion were excluded. So they had 1,224 women aged 18 to 60 years in the study. They looked at new instances of dermatologic conditions between women with the hormonal IUDs versus non-hormonal, and the odds ratios were as follows. So for acne vulgaris, the odds ratio was 2.514, confidence interval of 1.8 to 3.3. So as a reminder, an odds ratio is going to predict the odds of that event happening in the group versus the control. And if it has a number above one, that is an increased risk. If it has a number below one, that is a decreased risk. And if the confidence interval captures one, then it is insignificant. So they had a significant increase in risk of acne vulgaris, 2.5 odds ratio. Hirsutism, odds ratio was 0.4. So that's a less than one odds ratio, indicating the potential for a protective effect. However, their confidence interval here was 0.2 to 0.75, but their p value was 0.0025, which was greater than their set point for significance. So that was an insignificant finding, the hirsutism. They had
Wait a second. I thought p-values of 0.05 were considered standard. I figure this is still good.
Okay. Well, I may have misread how they explained it in the results, but regardless, so that's the 0.44 for the odds ratio of hirsutism, which is kind of contrary to what you would expect with androgenic progesterone.
Yeah. Acne goes up, but hirsutism goes down. What the heck?
Interestingly enough, rosacea's odd ratio also was lower. So it was 0.37. And the confidence interval was 0.28 to 0.49 with a significant P interval. And the androgenic alopecia was 0.1 with a confidence interval of 0.02 to 0.4. So the kind of mixed bag of pictures is a little difficult to explain, but they get into some ideas about why that might have presented in this way.
So just to break it down.
Yep.
Compared to women on copper IUDs, mm-hmm. those with hormonal IUDs have more acne, mm-hmm. but less hirsutism, less rosacea, and less androgenetic alopecia.
Yes, that's correct.
What's the deal?
Confusing, I know. There's some ways that they kind of hypothesize why this may make sense. So there's a few points that I want to highlight around this discussion. One of those is that these levonorgestrel IUDs are very helpful devices specifically in managing menstrual symptoms as well as preventing pregnancy and sometimes controlling other symptoms of patients who have PCOS. Now, they make a point that they didn't have a huge cohort of patients with PCOS, but I think this is very pimpable and important content. So the levonorgestrel IUDs have anti-proliferative effects on endometrium, and that actually may protect against endometrial cancer in patients with PCOS who have an elevated risk for that. So this is important to know. Patients with PCOS have a 2.7 times increased risk for endometrial carcinoma because they have long exposure of the endometrium to unopposed estrogen when they have anovulatory cycles. And the levonorgestrel IUDs actually decrease that risk because they're anti-proliferative on the endometrium and they can protect against the endometrial cancer. The levonorgestrel IUDs also, in several studies, have shown improved hyperandrogenism symptoms in patients with PCOS. So I don't know if that was part of the kind of bidirectional change that we saw in this study, but it is kind of an interesting point. And I think something that we don't teach well in dermatology, but as we are people who might recognize the signs of PCOS first, because they will present to us first, I think this is an important point for us to be aware of. So, going back to the article, in this cohort, there was a clear and significant increased risk of the development of acne vulgaris in patients with hormonal IUD implantation. And they found negative associations, as we said, between the IUD implantation and hirsutism, alopecia, and rosacea compared to women with the non-hormonal copper IUDs. The interesting parts of this, as they break it down, are that the risk of development of acne vulgaris after hormonal IUD implantation actually decreases with increasing age. So the younger the patient is when you implant the hormonal IUD, the more likely that patient is to get acne related to that IUD. So as a patient gets older, the effect of the hormone-releasing IUD on developing acne seems to be mitigated. I think that's kind of an interesting thing to point out. The hirsutism and alopecia discussion, they felt like potentially those symptoms might take more than a year to develop or present, and the delayed onset of these conditions may explain sort of the uniform effect of levonorgestrel on these androgenic dermatologic conditions, because that's a little bit confusing. And then they do bring forward that underlying diagnoses such as polycystic ovarian syndrome and obesity might contribute to the development of those conditions, which might be mitigated through the use of the levonorgestrel. They did attempt to evaluate women with PCOS, but they were statistically insignificant. The clinical encounter data was also not really a part of their data set, so they couldn't really evaluate for coding omission due to lack of insurance coverage for cosmetic procedures and things like that. They also put forward that there might be potential bias in reporting the conditions because women in whom acne developed in the short period were more likely to seek dermatologic treatment than women whom hirsutism or alopecia developed over a longer period of time. So they wanted to, of course, as any good author should, suggest further research into this area. I think that this study does a good job of supporting the phenomenon I think every practicing dermatologist has appreciated, that some women with hormone-releasing IUDs experience flares in their acne symptoms. And those flares are often well treated with drosperinone-containing OCPs. The drosperinone analog spironolactone manages those symptoms very well because it helps to sort of mitigate the hyperandrogenism brought from the levonorgestrel that is in the Mirena IUD.
Drosperinone-containing OCPs could also work. I talked to my OB-GYN colleagues, and they say they do put people on both OCPs and IUDs at the same time.
Yeah, it feels like overkill, but it doesn't not work. So that's an option as well. If you want to avoid the estrogen exposure, you could certainly just use the spironolactone. If you want to have the estrogen exposure on board to increase the sex hormone binding globulin in the plasma and soak up extra testosterone and other androgens, that also is a beneficial strategy. But of course, you want to consider things such as risk for blood clots if you're adding estrogen into the mix. So I think this is a good supportive piece of data for the association with acne and IUDs. I think the question of hirsutism and alopecia, as those conditions may take longer to develop, and also maybe missed until they reach sort of a critical mass, especially with alopecia. I think that that's something that you might need a longer study to pick up the risk for. And you'd also have to probably exclude patients with PCOS to kind of remove the corrective influence that levonorgestrel IUDs can have on that condition and see if in women without PCOS there was any influence on hair loss specifically or hirsutism with the levonorgestrel containing IUDs over a longer period of time. But I think it's a great initial study and gives us some information on sort of how and why this might happen and a good review of other things surrounding these types of devices and conditions.
Well, the business of it taking a long time to show up is true in the copper IUD contingent as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what this was comparing it to. So, and their ORs are quite marked. It's, you know, 0.1 for androgenetic alopecia, which means you got 10 times less odds of having androgenetic alopecia if you've got a hormonal IUD compared to a copper one. Interesting. Perhaps there's more to the human body that we have yet to discover when it comes to hormones and things.
Hormones are complicated animals.
So before this study, when I was in fellowship, one of my senior mentors, Saber Leitenberger, shout out to you, you were awesome. She speculated that the reason that some women get worse acne after they have an IUD placed is because they stop their OCPs to put in an IUD. And so she thought that a lot of these OCPs were helpful for acne and IUDs were kind of acne neutral. Which made a lot of sense, but this study suggests that actually there is something in these very low-grade hormones that are doing something. If you wanted to do a copper IUD, by the way, I looked this up, copper IUDs are 99.2% effective, and hormonal IUDs are 99.8% effective, so that's pretty equivalent. And the names are sometimes confusing as well. Again, you're welcome, listeners, I looked this up for you. So names, common names for hormonal IUDs on the market in the US are Mirena, which I think most people know, and then also Kylena, Liletta, and Skyla. Some newer things out there too.
There's one other confounding potential thing that I thought about, which is that the copper IUDs do potentially increase menstrual blood loss, and that might result in iron deficiency anemia. There was a study that showed iron deficiency anemia in patients who had the copper IUDs in about 15% of those patients. And as we know, iron is very necessary for hair growth, and iron deficiency states can cause alopecia. So I don't know if that particular kind of independent risk with the copper IUDs sort of changed the landscape for the question specifically relating to alopecia.
That's interesting. So you mentioned that this study used a health research network called TriNetX, which I had never heard of before. But interestingly, the other study you're planning to talk about today also used the same network, which looks like it has access to EHRs from all across the country and also other countries as well. So I was kind of wondering why they used only the University of Iowa data if they had access to TriNetX instead of using, you know, they had 1,200 women in this study. They could have had hundreds of thousands probably if they had really dug into this TriNet stuff, and they also could have looked at, you know, 5 years out, 10 years out if they wanted to do this longer duration thing. So I agree, kind of an interesting initial study, and the follow-up study kind of writes itself.
Yeah. I look forward to further work from this group.
Michelle, it's 2023.
Woo!
But let's pretend it's 2006. What are you doing in 2006, Michelle?
I was actually starting my first year as a dermatology resident at the Cleveland Clinic in beautiful, sunny Cleveland. Oh, just kidding. Beautiful, varied temperatures and all seasons present in Northern Ohio, which is a lovely place with lovely people.
Well, I was 26 years old. I had no inkling that I wanted to be a doctor. I met a 21-year-old woman named Lindsay, who would turn out to be my wife.
Lindsay!
If we were like most people, we were listening to Bad Day by Daniel Powder. Remember that song?
You had a bad day. Yep.
Yep, that's the one. We were going out to the movies to watch The Departed. We were staying at home and watching American Idol. And while we were doing that, Nisha Patel, Laurie Spencer, Joseph English, and Matthew Zierwas were writing an article on acquired ichthyosis. So,
sorry, I'm a fangirl.
This is from 2006. And I wanted to review this article because it's the most recent one I could find on acquired ichthyosis. And I have an adolescent 15 or 16 year old who I think might have it. So this is somewhat self-serving. And as long as you're shouting out to Math Zero S, I'll shout out to Joseph English, who I knew briefly in Pittsburgh when I was a med student there. So ichthyosis, we know it's super dry skin, perhaps with fish-like scales. That's where it gets its name, with the ichthy. And you might remember that in residency, we learned about a bunch of different genetic versions of ichthyosis. All of those, almost, manifest before adolescence. So if it shows up in adolescence or adulthood, it's more likely to be an acquired ichthyosis. And acquired ichthyosis has been associated with a bunch of systemic disorders, including infections, inflammatory disease, malignancy, metabolic disease, medications, and nutritional deficiency. And there are also a couple of later onset genetic versions, such as ichthyosis vulgaris sometimes, and Refsum disease.
Refsum is such a funny disease. Sorry, not to have at all. But the mnemonics around it are interesting.
Well, why don't we hit Refsum disease first then, since you've got some great mnemonics keyed up.
Okay. So this one, I have to give a shout out to my peeps at the Cleveland Clinic, because this was partially developed before I got there. But they talked about holding the person ransom for Refsum with salt and pepper shakers over their eyes and ears, because like they get the retinitis pigmentosa and sensory neuronal deafness potentially. So I have like a whole mnemonic about this where they hold him ransom that way. And he couldn't fight because remember, it's like phytanic acid that kind of gets,
Builds up,
accumulated in the tissues, yes. He couldn't fight because he couldn't have his spinach, because you can't have leafy greens because he's like Popeye, apparently. Or his milk for his bones, you know, because it's in there too. And then they get the ichthyosis. They also get a little bit of, I think, spastic diplegia of some kind or something like that. There's a neurologic defect with it. Did I hit that out of memory with no preparation?
Pretty good. The mnemonic that we used in residency was Refsum, like a referee. Apparently, my co-residents were sports fans, and they were like, you always want to fight with the ref, so that's how they got to phytanic acid, and
okay,
referees wear, like, the black and white striped uniforms for the retinitis pigmentosa salt and pepper thing.
Okay, and I looked it up. Keep going, sorry.
So these patients present usually before age 40, but it can be a late-onset ichthyosis. They usually have neurologic findings, sensory neuropathy, ataxia, decreased visual acuity for these reasons. It's rare. It's autosomal recessive. There are mutations in a couple different genes that are responsible for breaking down this phytanic acid stuff, which is found in dairy products, animal fats.
I found my mnemonic for it. It's kind of long, but it makes sense. So I did the whole like salt and pepper over his eyes and ears thing. And then he tried to fight, but I forgot this part. He didn't pack his pecs, because pack is for the PAHX gene, which is phytanol CoA hydroxylase, and PEX is for PEX7, which is pyroxin 7. It's a peroxisomal enzyme. So he tried to fight, but he didn't pack his PEX. Isn't that cute? And then he didn't have his spinach for his muscles or his milk for his bones, because you can't have the, you know, leafy green vegetables or dairy products. So they get muscular wasting and skeletal anomalies. And then I said he didn't have the heart for it because he had arrhythmias with heart block. So it's like a whole thing.
Pretty good. I also found one source that said they can have yellow nevi because they have lipid buildup in their nevi.
I have had a few patients that have those, and I always worry about this with them. So I'm like, you okay? But they're fine.
If you want to find this on biopsy, you can, but you want to send the sample in saline so that people can do lipid stains on it, because you find lipid-containing vacuoles and basal keratinocytes. So that's one potential acquired ichthyosis, though it's not truly acquired. It might seem that way. So if somebody has got ichthyosis that suddenly showed up before age 40 and they have some of these neurologic findings, then you want to be looking for Refsum disease. As long as we're talking about the genetic stuff, ichthyosis vulgaris is the most common type of ichthyosis. It's like 1 in 250 people. It occasionally just manifests late, like in adolescence. So if maybe my patient just has ichthyosis vulgaris, family history is helpful. It's autosomal hemidominant is how I usually see it described. It's the only thing I've ever seen is described as hemidominant, though there's got to be other things that are. It basically just means if you got one allele, you have the disease, and if you get two alleles, you have it a lot. It's a filaggrin mutation, as I think we all know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so other stuff that can cause it. I'm just going to rattle through these real quick. So infections. The most prominent one is HIV, and then plus or minus HTLV, which is usually not something people in the United States get, but I feel like I remember Southeast Asia and the Caribbean, HTLV, human mm-hmm. T lymphocyte virus or something.
Leukemia, yeah.
Inflammatory diseases, dermatomyositis, lupus, sarcoid, GVHD, eosinophilic fasciitis, Malignancies associated with acquired ichthyosis include leukemias, lymphomas, leiomyosarcoma, mycosis fungoides, multiple myeloma, Kaput C sarcoma, cancer of the lung, and cancer of all of the female stuff, ovary, cervix, and breast.
All that female jazz.
Yeah, all that jazz. It's also been associated with lymphatoid papulosis, LYP, at least once. Metabolic disease can cause it. Chronic hepatic and renal disease can. Renal failure, with or without hyperparathyroidism. Also hypopituitarism, hypothyroidism, hyperparathyroidism, and just plain old diabetes. Medications, not as many as you would think. A lot of the ones they cite are really exotic, so I'm not going to mention those. But cimetidine, kind of an interesting one that could potentially cause it, and hydroxyurea. And then nutritional deficiency, I always think of Phrynoderma, the vitamin A deficiency, like toad skin. Mm-hmm. They don't mention that one specifically. But
hello,
they do say,
every
hello,
time
baby.
I think of the frog.
the frog with the top hat.
Yep. The hello, my baby. Hello, my head. Because that's in my PowerPoint that I talk about this side effect with. Sorry. Go ahead.
But he has nicely moisturized looking skin.
That's true. He'd have to have been left out in the sun for a little while.
It's toad skin, not frog skin.
That's a good point. Fine.
It's time to alter your PowerPoint.
You're right. There. I got to find a good toad there. A Mr. Toad would be good.
How about Toad from X-Men?
Okay.
Anyway, so if we're thinking about nutritional deficiencies, you want to consider malabsorption, malnutrition, essential fatty acid deficiency can do it, pancreatic insufficiency, which can be caused, of course, by many things, celiac disease. Yes. A biopsy that supports ichthyosis, and you'll have to fact check me on this one, some compact hyperkeratosis and a reduced or absent granular layer are normally what's seen. If you're lucky, biopsy could tell you the underlying cause of an acquired ichthyosis. That's usually only the case for CTCL and sarcoid. If you're taking a biopsy, you want to take from the area of maximum keratosis. So probably that's all great stuff. And the most important thing that came out of this article is this excellent algorithm or flowchart they've got in here. So got an adult comes in with new onset ichthyosis. First, you want to decide if they have ichthyosis vulgaris or Refsum's disease, or if they just have boring old xerosis, so just dry skin, or if it's truly acquired ichthyosis. And if you've decided it's none of those things, it is acquired ichthyosis, and you have to like rule out this gigantic list of other things that could be responsible. First, you got to do a good history and physical, of course. So you want to talk about their medications, their diet, their review of systems. You want to look at their lymph nodes. You can check their muscle strength for something like dermatomyositis. You can think about doing this biopsy like we talked about. And for initial screening labs and studies, they recommend a chest x-ray. I assume that's for like lymphoma, leukemia, and sarcoid. CBC, ANA, LFTs, TSH, HIV, BUN, creatinine, so probably just a BMP, fasting glucose, the age-appropriate malignancy screening. That's sort of like the initial thing. And then if all of those are negative, then you keep on going. You can do a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, SPEP, UPEP. You can check CPK and aldolase for dermatomyositis. You can check the celiac-specific stuff. For malnutrition, you can look for albumin and total protein. I think you can check vitamin A. They don't mention it. For hypopituitarism, you can check ACTH, prolactin, growth hormone. For hyperparathyroidism, PTH and calcium. And then you can check HTLV titers, I guess, as well. So a good reference for you to look back on if you think you've got a patient with this, like I think I might have. We ended up putting this guy on cyclosporin to see if it was inflammatory after all. I think he's supposed to come back next week, so if he's better, I won't need this article after all, at least for now. But if he's not better, we'll look into this. I did a bunch of labs on him, by the way. They were all normal, though I don't think I checked HIV. Finally, for treatments, they recommend humectants. We have a bunch of funny names in dermatology. Humectants, emollients, moisturizers. Apparently, humectants basically the same thing as a moisturizer. So they recommend lactic acid, glycolic acid, or pyruvic acids. And then keratolytics can sort of peel the scales away if they've got thick scale, like salicylic acid, urea, propylene glycol, and lactic acid. And one brief little tidbit, the first historic reference to ichthyosis was from 250 BC in an Indian text where they referred to Ekakushtha, skin disease like scales of a fish.
That's really cool. I think the ichthyotic variant of sarcoidosis is underrecognized, so I'm glad that they highlighted that in this article. Ichthyosis is one of those things that can be, you know, really mundane, but it could also be quite striking, and sometimes it can indicate something very serious when it's like paraneoplastic or associated with sarcoid or with potentially dermatomyositis. So excellent review.
Yeah, so, I thought it was good. It was 2006, though. I wonder if there's been a lot of movement in it. So, friends, if you want to write another one, maybe it's time for an update, though that's all still looks like it's quite useful for my patients.
So, a medication that could cause ichthyosis potentially might be isotretinoin. How about that segue? You like it?
Okay. Perfect.
So we're going to review this article out of the British Journal of Dermatology. This is kind of, I think, banner-bearing article for the current zeitgeist. So we're very happy about this publication. It's Isotretinoin and Adverse Neuropsychiatric Outcomes Retrospective Cohort Study Using Routine Data. Chief authors are Tapio Pallajärvi and Sina Frazel. And they're out of the departments of psychiatry and forensic psychiatry and dermatology at Oxford University and University of Eastern Finland. How fun is that? Finland. Sorry. So nice, broad, and varied authorship. They wanted to go over the fact that severe neuropsychiatric outcomes have been reported in patients with isotretinoin, but the evidence is inconclusive and complicated by methodological limitations. So they did something I think was very, very intelligent. They put together cohorts comparing patients who had a diagnosis of acne but no treatment, a diagnosis of acne treated with topicals only, a diagnosis of acne treated with oral antibiotics, and a diagnosis of acne treated with isotretinoin. They had large cohorts of each group, and they compared them with each other to look for increased risk of adverse neuropsychiatric outcomes. And they made a very intelligent point, which is that we know acne by itself can be a risk factor for neuropsychiatric disease and for neuropsychiatric comorbidity, because when you have a condition that affects your visible presentation to the world, it can impact your mood, especially a condition that tends to hit in the early developmental years in which many of these neuropsychiatric symptoms or diseases may be developing. So it's a very significant condition in a significant time in people's life, and it carries, independent of any treatment, an increased risk of neuropsychiatric outcomes. So they use the different treatment methodologies to sort of divide the patients into categories of severity. And I think that that's a very astute observation. Patients with more severe acne tend to have more severe neuropsychiatric comorbidities. And so dividing them thusly allowed for more accurate comparison. Because studies in the past, which have compared patients on isotretinoin with acne to healthy controls without acne, that's a very disparate association when you're looking at very different groups of patients, when you're discussing people who do or don't have a condition that can affect their psychological well-being. So they looked at patients between 2013 and 2019 who had a diagnosis of acne in any of those different treatment protocols, who were then followed for 1 year after their index prescription or diagnosis. And the database that they utilized included over 12 million patients aged 12 to 27. And they had 30,866 patients who had been prescribed isotretinoin for acne, about 45,000 that had been given oral antibiotics, 108,000 that had been given topical anti-acne agents, and about 79,000 patients with acne but without any anti-acne prescription. So that was sort of their baseline control group. And then they propensity score matched for baseline confounders and reported their odds ratios of the incident neuropsychiatric outcomes in these patients who had acne exposed to different treatments. For those exposed to isotretinoin, their incident neuropsychiatric outcome risk had an odds ratio of 0.8, which, as we talked about before, is actually a mitigating factor or a protective factor. So a decreased risk of neuropsychiatric outcomes with a 95% confidence interval of 0.74 to 0.87. So significant, not capturing one, compared with those on oral antibiotics, and then also compared with those on topical anti-acne medicines. And they sort of break that down. They also put some very important points forward, I think, which is that patients who are on isotretinoin definitely experience more incident physical symptoms, and that the incident physical symptoms in a patient who's already vulnerable, especially if they're experiencing a flare, which can occur early in treatment with isotretinoin, especially at higher doses, those patients may have several things kind of stacking on top of each other that create more of a risk for psychiatric comorbidity, and that those patients may need more direct attention. So acne severity is something that I think needs to be looked at in all of these studies longitudinally. To the meat of the article, when you don't control for acne severity by using information of the different types of treatment, acne diagnosis was associated with an increased odds of 1 year incident adverse neuropsychiatric outcomes with an odds ratio of 1.46, confidence interval 1.43 to 1.5, compared to patients who did not have acne but were otherwise similar. when you match for all covariates for patients with topical anti-acne agents, so this is the least severe group of acne patients, their increased odds for incident adverse neuropsychiatric outcomes was 0.16 with a confidence interval of 1.09 to 1.22. When you compared them to patients with the acne diagnosis with no prescription, so milder acne. When you're looking at patients who are on oral antibiotics, the increased odds ratio for the adverse neuropsychiatric outcomes was 1.19, and the confidence interval there was 1.11 to 1.27 when you were comparing them backwards to the topical anti-acne agents. So again, kind of a good demonstration that increased acne severity increases the risk of neuropsychiatric outcomes. For isotretinoin exposure, it basically just maintains the risk of having acne, but it does not add to it. So the odds ratio for incident neuropsychiatric outcomes in patients with isotretinoin was 1.06. Interestingly, this confidence interval was 0.97 to 1.16, so that actually captures one, and so that actually doesn't show really any significant elevation of risk in these patients who had isotretinoin compared with patients who were diagnosed with acne with no prescriptions. So to kind of put that differently, patients who were on Accutane or isotretinoin for acne compared to patients who had acne but did not have any medication, the isotretinoin-treated patients did not have any elevated risk of neuropsychiatric outcome compared to those other patients that just had milder acne. So I think that that's very reassuring. We also have this data that their odds ratio for patients using the oral antibiotics, so patients who might have a similar severity of acne, their odds ratio there was 0.8 with that confidence interval of 0.74 to 0.87. So I thought that that was kind of impressive that you sort of seem to mitigate the risk in those patients with the more severe acne. The kind of, I think, high point of the discussion is that isotretinoin doesn't seem to add to the risk of neuropsychiatric outcomes over and above what is associated with just severe acne, as expressed by the patients who are on the oral antibiotic regimen there. So that's kind of reassuring information. A few other things they brought forward were that the risk of self-harm is already increased in patients with acne before isotretinoin treatment. And sometimes I don't know that we take acne as a significant and independent risk for neuropsychiatric comorbidity, but I think that it's this study and other studies have indicated that that's something that we should pay some attention to. And that the physical side effects of the medicine should be considered during initiation of treatment. They advocate for patients who have more vulnerable neuropsychiatric states to, if you're going to start therapy, to start it at lower levels with close observation. But I thought that this was very reassuring information. And then there was also a very nicely written commentary on it that kind of went over these high points and discussed the fact that when you really, you know, you have to compare apples to apples to get information that actually is useful. And so comparing patients with severe acne to patients with severe acne on different treatment modalities is going to give you a more accurate representation of what's actually going on with this drug. Now, isotretinoin does cross the blood-brain barrier. Neurobiologists have looked at different mechanisms that might account for brain effects, especially in young patients. So I don't think that there's absolutely nothing to the potential risk of psychiatric comorbidity in these patients. But I find this study to be very reassuring in that I think a lot of the risk comes from just the severity of the acne and not specifically from the drug. What did you think, Luke?
I have a lot of thoughts. The first, of course, is yay! So back in episode 79, we discussed another big data study that said that suicidality specifically, like suicidal behavior and suicidal thoughts, decrease while people are on Accutane. That was the winner for the article most helpful in Daily Clinic in our Dermy Awards, which we just did in the last episode. And so this one, I think, is more broad in terms of psychiatric problems in general. So instead of saying, in my opinion, the latest and best research shows that Accutane actually decreases suicidality, I can now say actually decreases depression and poor mental health outcomes, because this is fairly convincing. Mm-hmm. Also, they use this TriNetX database again, which really looks awesome, because they say they used the algorithm to compare these things. I mean, it looks like a pretty good research tool. It includes like 12 million people total, but this particular study was looking at like 150,000 people with acne on these various treatments. So there's a lot of data here. And my next question is, does the FDA ever remove a black box warning from a medication? Because what's eventually going to put this to bed, if not this?
I think that they can under severe duress. Didn't they remove the black box warning from the topical calcineurin inhibitors, or did I dream that?
I couldn't tell you. I'm not sure. But that would be awesome if they did. And I remember when I was in residency, somebody, perhaps you, told me that it was like a senator's son who had unfortunately committed suicide and Accutane was blamed, and that started this whole firestorm. I was poking around online and that didn't show up immediately. It was more like there were half a dozen idiosyncratic case reports of suicide while on Accutane that got the ball rolling. But I was just looking into it again while you were talking, and there is this article from 2000 in the Wall Street Journal that says congressman blames Accutane, an acne drug, for his son's suicide. So I'm sorry that this person committed suicide. That sucks. But it looks like, I mean, it probably wasn't from Accutane, right? There are these occasional idiosyncratic reports of people who got like super depressed and suicidal on Accutane. They got better when you stopped Accutane, and then it happened again when you put them back on. So like anything is possible. Perhaps it does cross the blood-brain barrier and do this in 15 humans throughout the history of using Accutane. But overall, very reassuring. And like I will say, many of the black box warning on our dermatologic drugs, this one also doesn't seem to have a lot of basis in fact. Also, it's kind of annoying that we have to spend all of these research resources proving this is wrong, because like somebody once upon a time thought it was worth putting a black box warning on this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, whenever it's something that's a big, significant potential side effect, even if it's very rare, kind of people's knee-jerk reaction, understandably, is to kind of put the infinite kibosh on that. And I think the FDA's best version of that, it's like the no mercy and those like Mortal Kombat games or something like that, where it's like black box warning. So, and that's basically, I think, the tool that the FDA has to make physicians pay attention. And sometimes they've used it punitively. The imposition of the black box warning on the topical calcineurin inhibitors, I believe, was kind of a reaction to the use of the medication in young patients with small bodies, basically. So patients under the age of 2, specifically, the FDA was very concerned about, was my understanding, when they put that black box warning on the topical calcineurin inhibitors. But I think that a labeling update is, I think more studies may potentially support that. I think it will be a long time coming, probably.
Well, I feel like I am able to hold conflicting ideas in my head at the same time. And I can also understand where the FDA is coming from. Their job is to keep the population safe, right? Their job is not to tell us that drugs work or not. They're to keep the population safe. And so they act with the best data they have at the time. But I also worry that they don't update things enough when studies like this come along that say we really can update this. Because if we're talking about sort of resource utilization, then we talk about physician time and healthcare provider time, like discussing the black box warning and reassuring parents about it. We talk about parents and patients who get scared off by the black box warning and end up not using Accutane, even though it would be a good medicine for their acne. And also, according to this article, for their mental health. Mm-hmm. And that part can be pretty frustrating.
Yeah, I agree with you. And sometimes the patients that kind of need the medication the most are cut off from access to it because of a potentially spurious association. What do you personally do when you have a patient that has some psychiatric, some neuropsychiatric comorbidity that needs Accutane? I'll tell you what I do. So when I have a patient that needs Accutane that also has a neuropsychiatric history or significant comorbidity or family history, what I do is I make sure that they have a therapeutic relationship with a mental health professional. And then I actually correspond with that mental health professional to clarify, do you
Sorry,
feel that this patient...
I'm still not sure about that.
I think Siri just heard me and responded to me. Sorry about that. So I correspond with the mental health professional to kind of confirm that they feel the patient is safe to treat with isotretinoin. And the patient and I have a contract that they will continue their follow-up with their mental health professional throughout their course of treatment with isotretinoin. I also start on the lowest dose, which is 10 milligrams daily, and I monitor the patients very closely. We have a check-in phone call with them at 2 weeks to make sure that they're doing well. And then we continue through their course of treatment. And I've successfully gotten many patients who've even had prior episodes of inpatient admission and a few patients who have had previous unsuccessful attempts under close supervision. Now, that is extremely risky. The biggest risk for a suicidal attempt is a prior history of suicidal attempt. So that I only ever do with close work with the patient's mental health professional and approval from all of the people treating that person. And, you know, you have to have really good patient-physician relationship for that particular circumstance. But I 100% agree with you that sometimes this particular element of the package insert cuts off access to this medication for some of the patients who might benefit from it the most.
Your approach is a little bit more intense than mine. I usually just touch base with their mental health provider and say, hey, are you cool with Accutane? And they almost always say, yeah, go for it. And then they can arrange follow-up and stuff if they want.
Honestly, then mental health professionals have always been very comfortable with it. I was concerned the first, you know, several times I did this that I was going to get a, what are you thinking, letter back from the mental health professional. And of course, you wouldn't want to treat anybody who was unstable or in a state of imminent danger, like, you know, address, you know, the whole body first before the skin is important, but their life is more important. Dead, beautiful skin is not useful to anyone. So I think that the most important thing is just, you know, treating the patient on a patient by patient incidence. And that's the point that they also bring forward in the commentary, which is that, you know, the adverse outcome from a severe neuropsychiatric event can be death. So you certainly want to pay attention to this potential risk, even though as a population, it seems that that risk is very low if it exists at all.
Yeah. One final thing they brought up in the paper that I was thinking as I was reading through it is this effect they found could easily be underestimated, like the protective effect of isotretinoin on patients' mental health, because they were comparing it to people on antibiotics. And people on isotretinoin, we see every month that we're hypervigilant about their mental health and their emotional state and their mood. So we probably have a much smaller, lower threshold to say, oh, you seem kind of moody. Let's, you know, have you see somebody or diagnose this or get it taken care of before we restart the medicine. So the fact that even with that issue, isotretinoin seems protective is especially reassuring.
I agree.
All right. What a fun way to end the show. So that's all the time we have for today, friends. Thanks for hanging out with us. And thanks to Steve Feldman for joining us, of course. And thanks to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for sending us Michelle. Thanks also to our continually enlarging Team Dermosphere, a group of enthusiastic and skilled medical students who help keep this moving along. Our team now includes Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Aparna Nayak, Neha Deo, Haley Walsh, and Angie Huang. Thanks for all of your help, guys. We appreciate all you do. If you would like to reach out and say hello to us listeners, you can do so through social media. We can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which has links to all of the original articles, as well as all of the winners and runners-up for the recent Dermy Awards. It's also a good way to reach out to us. You can also find us on our other podcast.
Our other podcast is called Skincast. It is a podcast for people who want to learn how to take the very best care of the skin they're in. It is directed at lay people. It's about 15 to 20 minutes per episode, and they're usually 1 to 2 topics in bite-sized episodes to help people just better understand these conditions. We have topics ranging from allergic contact dermatitis to Halloween makeup, acne and diet, hair loss treatments, psoriasis and eczema and atopic dermatitis and sun protection. So there's a lot of good information out there for patients.
Happy New Year, everybody. Hope 2023 treats you well, and we will see you in 2 weeks.